It's now time for the Fantasy 411 podcast.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Fantasy 411. I'm Matthew Leach talking fantasy baseball with MLB.com's lead fantasy writer, Fred Zinke. And we have an awful lot to talk about. And we will start with some bad news from nearly any perspective. Bad news for the game, bad news for the Pirates, bad news for fantasy players. Starling Marte suspended 80 games for a violation of the joint drug policy. We talk fantasy baseball here, so we're going to talk the fantasy ramifications, and there are a lot of them here. And it starts with Marte himself. If you have him, are there leagues shallow enough where you would drop him?
I think it has to be considered probably in some shallow formats. I mean, I think in 90% of leagues you keep him. I could see there are leagues that basically don't have a bench, you know, that have either no bench or a one- or a two-man bench. In that format, I think it would be very hard to keep him. In most leagues, I think I would keep him. I saw that he was dropped in many Yahoo leagues. Maybe some of that was an overreaction. I mean, you will get approximately 70 games from him when he comes back, which is pretty significant from someone who is, I'd say, on average about a third-round pick in most mixed leagues this year.
In his absence, the Pirates are saying for now that they are going to sort of shuffle that spot, and it's left field that comes open. But they're saying for now they're going to kind of shuffle that spot. McCutchen moves to center, and then you've got Polanco. Is there anybody you like to get a lot of opportunities or to really produce in their opportunities with the opening that comes up in Pittsburgh?
Yeah, I think this is an interesting opportunity for Adam Frazier. I mean, I don't think he's going to be a high-end fantasy performer, but this is someone who has 190 at-bats in the majors now and has hit an even 300. He has a little bit of power and a little bit of speed, so he is someone who, you know, I mean, from a Pirates perspective, if he could play fairly regularly in their outfield and produce a high batting average, you know, he can draw some walks. He could be someone who just solves that problem for the Pirates for the next 80 games, which means that in 15-team leagues and even some 12-team leagues, he could be fairly valuable if he can get regular playing time.
Now, the other guy who obviously gets a lot of conversation here is Austin Meadows, one of the top prospects in the game, ranked top 10 prospect overall across the board. Coming off a very nice year last year, split between between AA and AAA. But he scuffled a little bit at AAA last year, hit for some power in a limited showing, but hit .214, and is scuffling at AAA again this year. He's hitting .146, one home run. Now, look, it's very early. Nobody's saying that Austin Meadows is not still a top prospect, but I think that's a pretty good indication that this is not suddenly going to be the Austin Meadows show. If Frazier doesn't do what they hope, or if that left field doesn't work out the way they hope, and in a month or two Meadows has gotten it together, maybe he gets a look. But does this in any way affect your valuation in the near term of Meadows? Are there any formats or any strategies where somebody wouldn't already have him where they'd be looking to add him?
I don't think so. I don't plan on trying to pick him up in any 15-team leagues this week, and he's probably already owned in NL-only formats. As you said, he isn't hitting well right now in the minors. I don't see why they would, you know, increase his timetable when he's not hitting well. And when someone like Frazier has hit well in the majors, I think you just go with the guy who's already on your roster until such a time where Frazier's hitting .220 and Meadows is now playing well. I don't think both of those things will necessarily happen in the next 80 games. I think Frazier could hold his end of the bargain from a real baseball perspective and produce a decent batting average, and I don't think Meadows will, like in the near future, rake to the point in AAA where they say, okay, we just have to bring him up. He could make such a massive impact. So I don't think that this really changed. In my eyes, it doesn't really change things with him.
We move on to a couple of the more pleasant stories from the year so far. Eric Thames and Marcell Ozuna have been two of the top hitters in the game. One a little more surprising than the other, though I think some people were on Thames coming into the season. Ozuna is a guy that I think a lot of people have expected to bust out for a while. Personally, I am very high on Ozuna. I don't think he's going to keep hitting .404. But I think he is a guy to take very seriously as a potential top outfielder. I'm less sold on Thames. I think he'll hit for some power. I think he'll be productive. You know, what he's done already isn't going to go away. But I wouldn't bet on, I don't know, he might hit 30 now. I think now, with the head start he's got, I think 30 is a pretty good number for him. But I don't think he is a huge star-type player going forward. Where do you see those two guys? Do you agree with me that between the two, you'd rather have Ozuna going forward?
Actually, I think I might be a little more excited about Thames, but it's very close for me. I'm high on both of them as far as their ability to continue. Obviously, like as you mentioned already, they're not going to continue on the pace they're on. That kind of goes without saying, but needs to be acknowledged. But it's really whether they were projecting that they're going to make a major increase, you know, in their overall production this year. And I think that both of them will. What's encouraging for me about Thames is he's hitting for power, but he's also, his strikeout rate has been fine. Like, he's on pace, you know, if he plays 145, 150 games, you know, he might have 130 strikeouts, 135. That's a really reasonable total for a power hitter. So, I don't know. I'm really intrigued by Thames. I also have been, like, I was kind of on him, and he hasn't done this yet, but I was kind of on him back in spring training with a Brewers team that doesn't mind stealing bases to maybe steal 10 bases this year. Now, that hasn't happened. He hasn't been stealing bases yet, but that it's early. Like, it could still happen. So if you could get 30 home runs from Thames and 8 or 10 steals, I think his batting average is, if the strikeout rate can continue to be reasonable. Now, baseball is a game of, you know, matchups and adjustments, and will pitchers adjust to him as they study him more throughout the season, kind of the new Thames that's back in the majors? That's totally possible, and maybe I'm not giving enough credit to the adjustments that pitchers will make on him in the coming months, but I'm really encouraged by what I've seen so far.
And that's part of it for me, is I think we're now at the point where Ozuna is, you know, things have sort of been sorted out between him and pitchers. You know, it's not like we're suddenly going to discover something on him. It's not like pitchers are going to suddenly discover a hole or discover a new way to get him out. The other thing is, pardon the shameless plug here, but I wrote something on Ozuna this week and taking a look at him through a StatCast lens. And it's impressive. He is absolutely obliterating the ball like few guys right now. And that's part of what I look at with him is, boy, I'm calling it up right now to take a look at the numbers here. But he's just crushing the ball. Exit velocity on fly balls and line drives, as of a couple of days ago, led the majors. And that's the thing that really jumps out to me. When Ozuna is a guy, we've always kind of thought he had power, and he is really coming into that. And hopefully somebody's going to get into his ear and say, hey, hit in the air a little more, because he didn't hit the ball hard on the ground. But that, to me, it's some of those peripherals on him make me very excited. And again, a guy that we've known for a while and has shown flashes of it before, and it's just a matter of keeping it together. I'm really high on him. He was a guy I had targeted coming into the year. This goes back to something we've talked about. We tend to like the guys we liked. But, you know, I do think that he is a guy to take very seriously, and a guy that I think we're probably going to have, you know, a tier higher in next year's pre-draft rankings.
Yeah, maybe one final comment on Ozuna is some fantasy owners will remember he was really good in the first half of last season as well, and then faded in the second half. I'm not buying at all that second half fade means he's, you know, not a second half player. I don't buy that at all. I think it's quite likely that second half fade was injury related last season, which also makes it even more encouraging that he's off to a great start, because this could have been someone who had a breakout year last year, maybe, if not for some nagging injuries down the stretch.
Yep. We stay with breakouts. I'm going to shuffle the order. A little inside baseball here. I'm going to shuffle the order that Fred sent me, because I think this is a nice segue into a couple of more breakout/surprise guys. Trey Mancini and Avisail Garcia, and kind of a similar pair of guys in that one sort of came from nowhere and one is a guy that people were high on a while ago. I like Mancini. I like him kind of like I like Thames, in that I think he's a guy who's going to hit you some home runs, not continue what he's doing now, and as long as your expectations are reasonable, he'll be a good guy to have. I am down on Garcia, but that's partly because, man, I've been waiting so long for this, and I know he's only 26, and maybe this is a year. He's still really young, and young veterans tend to be good stocks to buy. But, man, this guy's got 1,600 Major League plate appearances. I'm very skeptical that we don't already know what Avisail Garcia is. I hope I'm wrong. I'd like to see it happen. But if I had him, I would definitely be looking to sell high.
We totally agree. On Garcia, I would be really, really excited to sell high. I mean, BABIPs are all over the place early in the season, but his is 543. And, I mean, even in a world where they're all over the place, 543 sticks out. I mean, a high BABIP this time of year might be 423, something like that. 543 is, you know, ridiculously high. That's over 200 points higher than his career 327 BABIP. So, I mean, the batting average is going to come way, 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 way down, probably right back into the 250, 260 range of what he usually is. I think Mancini's more exciting. I do think the floor is a little higher on Garcia, and just in the sense that the White Sox don't really have other options. So he's going to play. Mancini,
right.
A lot of people asked me questions on Twitter about him on Monday. I was fairly negative. Since then, I went back and looked at it a little more, and I thought, you know, should I be more optimistic on Mancini? It's not really against him. It's just more he can play against left-handers, but where is he going to play in that Orioles lineup against right-handers? They're not going to sit Chris Davis. They're not going to sit Mark Trumbo. They're not going to sit Seth Smith. Are they going to sit Hyun-Soon Kim, who in his career so far is a 318 hitter against righties, but doesn't have power? But, I mean, it's hard to sit someone who's hit that well against righties. Now, maybe an injury happens to a player and then he gets the lineup. I just can't figure out how Mancini plays every day, and you have to play every day to be relevant in 10 or 12 team leagues.
My feeling there is something we've talked about before. When you've got that many spots, that many possibilities, if the guy hits, they'll find pretty good playing time for him. You know, if you're talking about a guy who can only catch and he's only going to play a catcher and there's a starting catcher, that's another matter. If you're talking about a guy you can plug in a few different places and there are a few different guys and most of those guys are limited in one way or another, I sort of feel like if he hits, they'll find the at-bats for him. They've done that pretty well. So I do suspect they'll find a way to do that. To me, the thing that gives me pause, and I'm going to sort of go against what I just said because I do like him. The thing that gives me pause is that 427 slugging at AAA last year. You know, that makes me a little worried about how much to believe the power. But, you know, he has hit for power before. He hit for power the year before in a year split between high A and double A. So he's shown it in the past. I'm just a little skeptical. But, again, I'm not saying, you know, give everything you got to get him. I'm just saying he's a guy I like pretty well. Again, talking about guys who have really produced maybe more than expected this year, Cesar Hernandez, guy I was a little skeptical about coming into the year. He's really producing. He's not showing speed, but he's hitting. That's really encouraging to me. I feel like he's a guy I think if he's sitting on a waiver wire, he's probably worth adding to your roster. I'm not saying he's going to keep this up, but this may be a guy that's just better than we all thought. Where are you on Hernandez?
Yeah, I like him. I'm intrigued by him. I'd like to see a little more base stealing from him. Actually, just more successful base stealing, because last year he was 17 for 30. So, I mean, if he was just a little better at base stealing last year and got the same amount of opportunities, he could have been in the 20s easily for steals. And I think he could do that. What I love when players, I've said this before, I love when players play to their skill set. And he's someone who's putting the ball on the ground really throughout his career, but especially last season, put the ball on the ground a lot. He's a fast runner. That will allow him to have a pretty high BABIP consistently because he's playing to his strengths. He knows he can't put the ball over the outfield fence that often. I know he's done it 3 times so far this year, but overall, I mean, 8 home runs would be a great year from him. If he keeps the ball on the ground a lot, he could possibly hit around 300. And if he hits 300 as a leadoff hitter, he could score 85 runs. And if he steals 20 bases, like at that point, he's fairly valuable as your middle infielder, even in a 10-team league.
Yeah. Chase Headley, another look. We're getting more of these. We've got a little more data to work with, so we've got more of these sort of hot and cold starts to talk about. Headley is a guy I am still lukewarm on. He's kind of been the same guy, the same fairly disappointing guy for a couple of years now. It's not that he couldn't produce, but if you go back even the last 4 years, you go back 13 to 16, and he's been pretty much the same guy. And you look at this year, the only thing that's really different is he's walking a lot. He's not really hitting for significantly more power than before. That on base means that he is scoring runs, and that's nice. But while we're talking about freaky BABIPs, he's at 485. So I think Headley could be, you know, look, I think Headley could be the 2013 guy, which isn't a whole lot different, but he hit 250 that year. You know, I think he could be a little better than that. Maybe he hits 260 this year, but you got an entire career of a guy that says he's an 11 to 14 home run player and one year that says he's something different, I'm pretty inclined to believe on the 33-year-old player that the entire rest of the career is the true story and not the one year. I'm encouraged he's going to hit enough to keep his job. If I have Headley, I'm feeling good that, you know, he's a guy he's going to play. He's not going to play himself out of the third base job, which I think has been a worry at times. But I am definitely not buying that he is suddenly the 2012 version of Chase Headley again. Do you see something more there than I'm seeing?
No, not really. And in fact, I don't even think he's a sell high player in most leagues.
No.
They don't think you could sell him high. Like,
no.
If there's an owner in your league who you can convince that he's on the verge of a 2020 season or something because he has a couple homers and three steals so far and is going to hit 300, like, then go ahead, sell high. I don't even think he's a sell high. I think this is a classic case of a veteran player is hot. Go ahead and put him in your lineup.
Yep.
Enjoy the hot streak if it lasts for another week, if it lasts for 3 weeks. Just enjoy it and be ready to, you know, replace him at some point. I think he is a sneaky source always of, except for 1 year, basically a sneaky source of 7 to 10 steals. But, yeah, I think 15 or 16 home runs, maybe hits 260, but nothing that keeps him in even 12-team lineups on the long-term basis.
I'm a little worried about Jonathan Villar. He's also one of the hardest players to get a read on just because he has so many spectacular highs and lows in his game. The speed, the power, the strikeouts, he's a fascinating player and a hard guy to get a read on. But a guy who strikes out that much, it can go south. Things can go wrong for a guy like that. So I don't think that last year was a fluke, but I'm a little worried about that maybe he doesn't get back to those heights. But I also think there's potentially a buy low opportunity there because there's only one good year. I really kind of, like I said, I really don't entirely know what to make of him. Where are you on VR?
You're right that, I mean, okay, when we talk here on the podcast or what if I give someone advice on Twitter or something, you feel the need to kind of put your advice in a capsule, right? Like we can't say we're worried about him and buy low on him. But sometimes
right.
That is almost the right answer. Yeah, he's striking out a ton. He's striking out more than a batter can strike out and really keep his job on a long-term basis. At the same time, his BABIP's 147. So it's not just the strikeouts. And he's usually a high BABIP guy, like someone who can be in the 360s or 370s. So he's a good 200 points below that. You know, really, he's just that classic case of everything's going wrong right now, and probably his head is spinning where he's striking out more than usual. He's not even getting good luck when he is putting the ball in play. That's putting more pressure on him. I think overall I'm on the buy low side. I'm not expecting 62 steals again, but I could see this getting straightened out and him the rest of the way being a 250 hitter, 255 hitter, who does steal plenty of bases, hits the occasional home run. So if his owner's really panicking, I'll also say this. I think VR could be an interesting buy-low trade target for Starling Marte owners who are trying to figure out where they're going to get those 40 steals from. And, you know, they're not going to pay for Jose Altuve, so VR might be someone they could get at a discount and hope that that makes up for what they lost with Marte.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. We move on to some slow-starting stars. Manny Machado, Eben Encarnacion, Robinson Cano. There's only one of those guys I am the slightest bit worried about, and I am worried about Encarnacion because of the age. He's a guy that I kind of feel like when it goes, it might go quickly. I don't think he's done. I don't think he's going to do nothing. I still think overall he's a relatively high floor player. The other two guys I expect to be stars for the rest of the year. I expect them to be basically normal from here on out. I could see Encarnacion not being the guy we're used to seeing from here to the rest of the year. Again, I don't think he craters, but he's the one of those three guys where if this is a down year, I won't be at all surprised. Are you any higher on him or lower or more worried about the other two guys than I am?
So I'm not worried about Machado, like even a 1 out of 10 not worried about him, and I'm not really worried about Cano. With Encarnacion, I agree with you, he's of the three the one that I'm the most worried about. That being said, from watching him for years with the Blue Jays, he often starts the season slowly. That just seemed to be, he always has that, he's always, for the past few years of the Blue Jays, had that one ridiculous stretch during the season where he just has like the 12 homer month or the 10 homer month. That never seems to be in the first two or three weeks of the season. He often started slowly. I'm just kind of looking at his month-by-month stats in the last 5 or 6 years, and you know, and his OPS in April, this is going back to 2012, his OPS is 785 in April, and it's 885 or higher in every other month. So 100 points lower in April than any other month. So being a slow starter, striking out a lot in April, has kind of been what he has always done. So that is enough, I think, for me to not want to write him off yet, and maybe even consider buying low on him if his owner is starting to have a lot of doubts creep into their head. That being said, with me having been kind of the low man on him for drafts already, he's kind of coming down, I think, in value to where I had him originally, so he probably wouldn't be a trade target of mine yet.
We move to starting pitchers, and James Paxton has been superb. Jameson Taillon, the results have been superb. Coming into the year, Taillon was one of those guys I really had my eye on. I really liked the potential. But right now, I am more intrigued by Paxton, and it's because of the strikeouts and the walks. Taillon has not been a guy who walks a lot of guys, but you know, there's a little bit of a disconnect between the runs and the strikeouts and the walks, and there is not that with Paxton. Out of these guys who, and we'll throw Danny Duffy in there too, he's been very good and sort of been emerging for a while now. Out of those three guys, I really think that Paxton might be the guy I would want from here to the end of the year. I think, you know, I still worry a little bit about the floor on Taillon. If I were trying to get that lightning in a bottle, get an ace in trade without paying ace prices, something we talk about here periodically, Paxton might not be the guy I went for, but I feel like he may have the highest floor of those guys and a pretty high ceiling. And I think he's the guy I'd rather have, but again, if I were really needed an ace, if I had an ace go down and I really just needed to get somebody who might be absolute top end, Taillon is probably the guy I'm going for out of those three. How do you rank them, both sort of overall and potential to pitch like a one?
Yeah, I think the potential to pitch like a one, I think I'm with you that Paxton's the guy because of the strikeouts. I don't think Taillon will get you. I don't think the Pirates will let him throw enough innings to
That's
get
fair.
You a huge strikeout total. But even if he did, I don't think he's there yet as a strikeout pitcher. But I think of the three, I would prefer to own Duffy because, to me, his floor is higher because I still really worry about injuries with Paxton and Taillon, both of them. And with Duffy, I mean, every pitcher I worry about injuries with, but I think with Paxton and Taillon are two that I still really worry about injuries with. So I'm kind of the mindset with Paxton, like I'm really excited about him, but until I see him put together that 30-start season, I'm not ready to believe it's coming. And it is, and we are early in a long season, and I wouldn't be surprised at all to see him injured at some point, just because I feel like his career has just been like checkered with kind of one injury after another, even if some of them aren't that big, but just he's someone who seems to have had trouble getting through a six-month season. So for that reason, I would actually, maybe if I was a Paxton owner, look at the sell high options. I think I'd at least maybe look around my league, maybe at a guy whose pitching started really poorly and might be willing to overpay and give you a really good player
right
to get this potential ace from me. And hey, maybe I end up at the end of the year, he's got 210 strikeouts, and I'm like, man, I should have never traded that guy away. But the injuries worry me enough that I would consider that.
Speaking of injuries, let's talk Rich Hill. That's gone badly, and for weekly transaction leagues, boy, has that gone badly. I don't think you can drop him, but I don't think you can trade him. What do you do? Please tell me, because I'd like to know, what do you do if you have Rich Hill?
Yeah, I think you're right. I don't think you can drop him, again, unless you're in a league with no DL and no bench, and you just aren't willing to live with the possibility of 100 innings or something from him. But you can't drop someone who on a per start basis is about as good as there is in baseball in the last year plus. So you have to keep him. You can't trade him away right now. I don't think you get good value. He might be a buy low candidate. Like maybe his owner is just so frustrated with him that you could give him, that owner, you know, just kind of a run of the mill reliable arm, and you know, and they would take it. Like for example, if you just had like a Marco Estrada type arm, would you trade him for Rich Hill?
Well, I'm telling you, on the other end of that, I would listen to that offer.
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting one that could fit owners in certain situations. Like maybe a team that's loaded with pitching that could trade their number four starter and take the gamble on Hill that, you know, that this blister thing comes around and that he's fine. But I was optimistic on Hill going into the season. This has been one of my worst calls so far in 2017, where I was optimistic on him. I just, in my head, I couldn't wrap my head around the fact that a blister from last summer was going to cause him problems this season. And it didn't give him problems, you know, throughout spring training. So like, I just didn't see this coming. But now the fact that it's happened two seasons in a row is, like, really concerning. And I don't know if I would take the over even on 110 innings now. Do you think that that's
Let's talk about
good,
something
like,
happy.
Do you think 100 to 110 innings is probably the right place to put him? He's also
I think it's a good number. I think it's a good number.
Yeah.
So that's why I say let's talk about something happier.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Michael Pineda, who, look, he's one of those guys that I never really lost my belief in, and maybe somebody will go dig it up me saying I'm off the boat, but it's just hard to look past the things he can do. And it's hard to believe that he's that much of an outlier. And it's starting to look like maybe he's not an outlier anymore. You know, the thing with somebody like Pineda is that if you drafted him, you probably believed in him. You know, if somebody has Pineda, then they probably saw this, wanted to see this coming, and probably are going to want to ride it out. So I think he's going to be a hard guy to acquire. But... man, I'd like to if I had the opportunity. I'm buying. I guess what I'm saying is I'm buying on Pineda. I think it only makes sense for those skills to turn into performance, and so it just kind of adds up for me. Are you a Pineda doubter or a believer?
I'd say I'm enough of a – you're right. I don't think you can probably realistically buy on him in any leagues because the person who drafted him probably had enough faith that now they're happy with him. And he hasn't performed – he's performed really well, but not – like James Paxton well, like his ERA is still 3.44, so he hasn't performed so well that, you know, that you couldn't see this continuing. His career strikeout to walk ratio is 4.5. Like, that's really good. And he has some troubles with home runs, but not ridiculous troubles with home runs. So I think what's changed in my mind with Pineda is he's been so good to start the season that now I would keep him in my lineup even if he had a couple rocky starts. And last year I wouldn't have said that. If he had a couple, you know, four-inning, five-run starts, I'd probably bench him, even though he's striking out a lot of batters, I would probably bench him. Now he's moved up to the point for me where I wouldn't take him out of my lineup, even if he struggled in his next start, or even two starts.
No, I think that makes sense. Again, I'm very much intrigued by him.
Yeah.
On the other end, a couple of guys that I'm still not on board with. Andrew Triggs, we talked about already, not striking anybody out, but also not giving up runs. Wei-Yin Chen, inexplicably, is the only pitcher in the DH era to be better in the American League than in the National League. 7 no-hit innings in Seattle last night, giving him some feeling of what he used to do, not like that, but when he was with Baltimore. I am not on board with either of these guys. I can see a scenario where I would start Chen, you know, home against a bad offense that couldn't hit lefties or in a friendly ballpark. There are scenarios where I would stream Chen, but beyond that, I am a full-on doubter. He still gives up home runs even in the National League, and I just don't see it. I'm really, again, I could see streaming them both in the right circumstances, but I'm not picking either one of them up. Is there one of those guys that you particularly like?
I'd say I particularly like Triggs. I'll start with Chen. I think that he just is a mediocre pitcher coming off a really nice start. Like, I think he's a four ERA guy. As you said, you stream him if the matchups look nice or if you have some injuries. But he's not someone I'm racing out to get. The intriguing thing for me with Triggs is that his strikeout rate so far this season, like, he hasn't given up an earned run. His strikeout rate so far this season is really low and doesn't look like the type of pitcher who hasn't given up an earned run in three starts. But his strikeout rate last year, now I know he was in the bullpen for some of his innings last year, but his strikeout rate last year was really nice. It was 8.8. So it's like small sample sizes all around right now, and I'm willing to give him a little bit of the benefit of the doubt that, like, obviously the ERA is going to rise way up, but maybe he will have a reasonable strikeout rate. Like, it's weird that he's pitching well and not striking anyone out, that maybe kind of both of those things will correct, and maybe he could be a mid threes or 3.7 ERA kind of pitcher. I think there's at least something we're speculating on if you have an open roster spot with Triggs, whereas with Chen, to me, there isn't.
We will get to closers and two-start pitchers in just a moment, and boy, is there a lot to talk about with closers. Before we do, I want to take a minute to tell you about the MLB Pipeline podcast, focusing on all things draft and prospect-related. MLB Pipeline's draft and prospect gurus, Jim Callis and Jonathan Mayo, join Tim McMaster each week to talk about what's going on in the universe of MLB's future stars. Last week, Jim, Jonathan, and Tim broke down some top prospects off to strong starts like Manuel Margot, and of course discussed Tim Tebow's minor league performance so far. Search for MLB Pipeline in iTunes or wherever else you get your podcast and click subscribe. We say it all the time. I'm going to keep saying it. These guys are absolutely as good as it gets at what they do. And if you have any interest, and as a fantasy player, you should listen to the Pipeline and you should read their stuff as well.
Yeah, I mean, something right back from the beginning of the show when I found out about the Marte suspension yesterday, Pipeline was one of the first places I went just to get their update on how Meadows has been playing this season and their comments on him, and like that helped formulate a full opinion. Whereas my first reaction was, oh, Meadows, he could be up really soon. And then the more you read, the more you see how these players, and I mentioned that earlier on one of our podcasts, that you know, you got to keep up with these prospects during the season because their values are constantly changing.
We move on to closers, and as I said, there's an awful lot of closer news, and a good bit of it is bad, which I guess is the way you get closer news. If closer news is good, then there's no closer news. Zach Britton hits the DL. The Orioles are sounding like they're not very concerned. I mean, obviously they're somewhat concerned because Zach Britton's really good, but they are not. They don't seem to be ringing big alarm bells. I am still, you know, I just have one of those general rules. When I hear forearm, I get nervous. When I hear forearm or triceps with a pitcher, I get nervous. Maybe it really is just that, but so often they'll say, yeah, just a tight forearm, he's fine. And then a little later, it's actually his elbow, and then a little later after that, it's significant with his elbow. I hope that's not the case. I'm not saying they're obfuscating. I don't think they are. I think a lot of times things that look and feel like forearms turn out to be elbows. And again, I hope I'm wrong, but I would be very hesitant with Britton, and again, I hope I'm wrong, but I will not be surprised if, I'll put it this way, whatever over-under you gave me on saves for him the rest of the year, unless it was just ludicrously low, I'd probably bet the under.
I mentioned in our notes Wade Davis, and that was the right where my mind went when I saw that Britton was going on the DL. I say all season, we just started, but so far this season, every time, and I saw Britton a lot, he pitched against the Blue Jays a lot because they kept beating Toronto early in the year, and he just didn't look the same. Like, his whip was really high. He wasn't giving up home runs, but he just didn't look as dominant. And I thought of Wade Davis last year where, you know, things went south a little bit, and then they put him on the DL, but it was a forearm, but they said, like, oh, it's not a big deal. He's going to be back right away as soon as he's allowed, and he'll be fine. And then he came back, and then he wasn't fine, and then he was back on the DL, and then he came back again, and then he still wasn't really fine and wasn't really himself the rest of the year. And I'm not saying that sample size of one player, you know, paints a picture for Britton, but that's where my mind went. I am also worried about him. I would be fine with trading, and it sounds like you would be too, fine with trading him away for a closer from that next tier, like a Cody Allen type. Roberto Osuna, you know, just trying to come up with some of those off my head. Would you even go to, like, David Robertson or someone like that?
I'd listen. Definitely listen.
Yeah, I mean, unless you owned Brad Brock, which is I think Brock will get most of the save chances. He's, to me, clearly the best reliever left in that bullpen. Has been really good since the start of last season. Darren O'Day hasn't been, was okay last year and not good so far this year. If I owned Britton and Brock, then I think I might sit tight because, you know, then I feel like I'm covered either way.
Right. Fernando Rodney. We're still talking. It's 2017 and we're still talking about Fernando Rodney. As the kids on the internet say, what a time to be alive. I just can't and I won't. Even if I'm desperate, I am not buying Fernando Rodney under almost any circumstances. It's going to blow up. It is certainly going to blow up in that ballpark.
I would have said a couple years ago, I would have said there was a better chance that Fernando Rodney was making a fantasy baseball podcast than being discussed on a fantasy baseball podcast, you know, in 2017. But good for him that he's gotten that right where we're still talking about him.
But part of it really is the ballpark. I think he is at a point in his career where there are places where I could see it working, and I wouldn't be rushing to, but, you know, in places where he's been in recent years, Seattle, San Diego, Miami, Anaheim, places that are pitcher-friendly and flyball pitcher-friendly, I could see it. That is just going to go bad in Arizona. It just is. That's
well, I mean,
it goes.
It's already gone bad.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
But still closing. So,
and yeah, so be what you need to be looking for in Arizona is who's next.
Is Archie Bradley, before we move on from there, is Archie Bradley your stash guy in Arizona? Because I don't see anyone else who could be next. And Archie
Certainly
Bradley,
intriguing.
He's that classic intriguing name who's performing better out of the bullpen after being kind of written off as a starter. This Rodney thing, if for people who have Rodney in your lineup, like I get him out. Like, I know you've gotten five saves so far, but you also got an 8.53 ERA. It's not worth it. And soon you're going to keep getting the ERA but not get the saves.
And we are about to talk about some other guys you could possibly pick
Absolutely.
Up instead. The Angels, surprise, surprise, the Angels are not, in fact, closing by committee. It appears that Cam Bedrosian is the guy. I'm not confident he holds it all year. I still don't trust Mike Socha not to go to the veteran at some point. But I think he's the guy now. And I think he's a guy I'd like to have for now, as long as I was aware of the fact that at some point over the course of the year that might change. Do you buy that he's the guy now, and do you have any more confidence in him holding it all year than I do?
Yeah, I'm pretty excited about him. I know what you mean about Socha going back to the veteran like at some point, but Houston Street just went to the 60-day DL. So Bedrosian's getting a long time to prove himself. I mean, right now, he hasn't allowed a run. He has an 8-0 strikeout-to-walk ratio in six innings. He's converted all his save chances. He's going to give up runs at some point, but at the end of that 60-day DL, if he has plenty, well, it doesn't really matter how many saves he has. If he's converted pretty much all of the save chances he's been offered, and if his strikeout-to-walk ratio is great and his ERA is really low, I just think Socha will be in a position where he just can't go off him, and I do think Bedrosian's a good enough pitcher to make that happen. I'll be honest, I wish I had drafted him in more leagues because I was high on him all spring and then just didn't. Or got my closers early in some of the leagues or whatever, but I'm pretty optimistic that he can pitch so well that he just doesn't give the job back. I think he's a really nice investment for someone who's looking for a closer now who could be great but doesn't cost that, like we were talking about with guys like Paxton and starting pitcher.
Yep.
I think Bedrosian's that guy if you're looking for a reliever and you don't want to pay for the Aroldis Chapman.
Yep. We are talking on Wednesday morning, and last night, Tuesday night, after another bullpen adventure for the Nationals, Dusty Baker said, "This ain't working." He ain't wrong. I speculated coming into the year that part of why they chose Blake Treinen was that when they decided they wanted to go to Kota Glover, it would be easier to take it from him than to take it from Sean Kelly. It appears that time is coming. They have acknowledged they're going to reconsider. Kelly got the save last night. Kelly has pitched quite well after three rough ones to start the year. I was talking to Jamal Collier, our Nationals beat reporter for MLB.com. He believes that they are still going to be somewhat hesitant to make Glover the guy. I still think it could be in flux for a while, but Kelly is getting some strikeouts. He's not walking guys. He gave up three home runs in the first three games, and that's always been a little bit of a worry for him, but he looks like a closer, and if he gets the opportunity, I'm not sure he would keep it all year, but I think he'd keep it for a while, and I think he's the guy I'm picking up there if I'm speculating. Are you cutting bait on Treinen? Are you buying on Kelly? How do you look at that whole situation?
Yeah, I mean, if I had roster space, I think I would love to own. I'm not going to cut Treinen yet, but I'm not looking to buy low on him. And I don't think he'll be the closer. Maybe even by the time we record next week, and maybe even by the time we go to bed tonight. And as far as Kelly or Glover, I always felt that Kelly would be a really nice candidate, and we talked about him during spring training, but it does really seem like they didn't want him to be the guy, but maybe now they just have to make him the guy and give him a chance for a while at least to go with it. So I think if I had roster space for one, Kelly is the one I would pick up, but I wouldn't mind at least owning Glover for just the rest of the week to see where this goes. I mean, I don't know. It just, they seem so hesitant to go with Kelly all along. Maybe they're just backed into a corner now and they go with him. But Glover's pitched fine this year, 3.18 ERA, 1.06 whip, you know, 4 strikeouts and 5 2/3 isn't great. But if they were interested in him, really interested in him in mid-March, his FIP so far this year is 1.98. Like, he really hasn't done anything since the regular season started to change the minds of those in that organization who wanted him to be their closer.
One more. We move to Texas, where we have looks like we've talked about that. Seems like we've talked about for absolutely ever. And Dyson goes on the DL, and for now it's Matt Bush. But I think a lot of people are still speculating that may become Jeffress. I picked up Bush in our office league. I'm intrigued. I'm a little nervous about the health, but I think he's a guy to go. But are you intrigued enough in Jeffress to maybe, if you missed out on Bush, at least pick him up as a hedge?
Maybe in a 15-team league. I'm pretty excited about Bush. I mean, the health is definitely a concern. This is someone who did just miss a really, really small amount of time, but did just miss some time, you know, with an injury. So the health's a concern, but I can really clearly see Bush just running with this. Like, if he can stay healthy, because he can rack up strikeouts, which Dyson can't, I could see Bush, while Dyson's on the DL, getting 3 or 4 saves, you know, striking out more than a batter per inning, and then he just rolls with it because Dyson was struggling so mightily and would fit really nicely as a guy who gets a ton of ground balls. Like, he'd fit really nicely in those earlier innings coming in with runners on base. So I would really like to own Bush. I would like to own him more, for example, than Brad Brock, even though I'm worried about Zach Britton, because I can just see really clearly how Bush could just take the role and run it. And I would rather own Bush than any of the Nationals relievers. Do you feel the same way about, would you rather own Bush than any of those Nationals relievers?
I think so. If you told me one of those guys was the guy, then that would change it. But for now, while we feel like it's Kelly, we don't really know. I think if we don't know, then I'd rather have Bush. I think if we know at some point, then it becomes a closer call.
Yeah, I mean, I think of Bush as, you know, there's no reason he has to give the role back. Like Brad Brock, if Zach Britton comes back healthy, Brad Brock has to give the role back. Bush doesn't have to give the role back. So when I see a good pitcher who doesn't have to, who has a chance here to get an extended look and doesn't have to give the role back, that's when I can get excited and see that potential to even get 35 more saves. I mean, Dyson did that last year, came in during the season and got more than 35 saves.
We move on to the 2-start pitchers, and it's an interesting group. There are definitely some guys I like in there. Miguel Gonzalez, Kansas City and at Detroit. Jason Vargas at the White Sox and home for Minnesota. Hyunjin Ryu at San Francisco and home for the Phillies. Francisco Liriano at the Angels and home for the Rays. Amir Garrett at Milwaukee and at St. Louis. Joe Ross at Colorado and home for the Mets. Chad Kuhl home for the Cubs and at Miami. Brett Anderson at Pittsburgh and at Boston. I like about half that list, honestly. I really like Ryu. I just like the pitcher, and the matchups are not bad. I like the matchups for Liriano, and I feel like he's a guy where you stay away from bad matchups and dive into good ones because he can be so good when he's good. I like Garrett pretty well. Those aren't great matchups. At Milwaukee's a tough place to pitch, and St. Louis can hit. And I like Kuhl. I even like Anderson okay, though I'm not crazy about at Fenway, but that's a pretty tasty list of pitchers. Who stands out for you out of that list?
Yeah, you're right. It is a really interesting list this week. I would use Liriano in pretty much every league. You could get more than 15 strikeouts from him in a 2-start week. I'm okay with using Vargas in 12 and 15 team leagues next week. I just think at the White Sox, home to the Twins, is fine. Like, I don't think he'll be awesome, but he should be fine. And I feel the same way about Ryu at the Giants and home to the Phillies. I think he'll be fine, not amazing. I would probably stay away from Brett Anderson. Just, he's coming off a rough start. I do think the at Pittsburgh's fine, but the at Boston really worries me. Boston's, I think, still for me the number one lineup that I'm avoiding. And if they're not, then the number one thing I'm avoiding is still the Rockies at Coors Field. And that's what's giving me pause on Ross. I really like Ross as a pitcher, and I'm intrigued. And if he was dropped in a league because he started the year in the minors as a technicality, you know, because they're put because he's their fifth starter, I would really want to pick up Ross. I'm just, can you use him for that at Coors Field to get the home against the Mets? I think in a 15-team league I would go with him, but I don't think I would in a 10 or a 12.
All right, well, that's the Fantasy 411 for this week. Thanks, everybody, for taking the time to listen. Thanks, Fred Zinke, for taking the time to talk. We'll talk to you again next week.